Countrywide on ABC Radio.
I'm absolutely calling on the Deputy Prime Minister to pay attention to his own report.
Growers work from sun up to sun down, so
Countrywide.
We need to speak to these growers 1 o'clock in the morning.
And to actually act on behalf of the farmers.
They're going
to
get it from the Yanks or the French or whoever. Let's get our foot in the door and let's be the first.
Countrywide, the politics of food and farming on ABC Radio.
G'day. Welcome to Countrywide. I'm Lucy Cooper. Coming up, a new Australian record has been set for the biggest corn crop.
23.267 was the numbers that we came out with. That was about a bit more than a tonne better than the previous record, so fantastic.
And how do you know your extra virgin olive oil is really extra virgin? A new program is hoping to give shoppers peace of mind.
What we're really looking for is compliance with the Australian standard, which we have for olive oil, and also making sure that there's compliance on the label.
That story and more coming up. First up, a new development in the supermarket review. Supermarkets could be forced into a mandatory code of conduct with their suppliers if the government adopts the recommendations from a report by former Labor MP Craig Emerson. Mr. Emerson has recommended a confidential complaint system and fines up to $10 million or 10% of the annual turnover for the most egregious breaches by a supermarket. But he has stopped short at recommending divestiture laws. He outlined his recommendations to Sally Sara.
Have ACCC watchdog enforcement through a mandatory code, but also keep some of the provisions of the existing voluntary code where people are encouraged to sort things out amicably through mediation, but ultimately, if necessary, through arbitration. And I'm asking the supermarkets to accept arbitration and the outcome of arbitration, interestingly, under the Constitution. That can't be required by a government or the ACCC, so I'm asking them to sign up to that.
What kind of penalties or fines would be in place if the big supermarkets are not towing the line?
Well, if they do it in a very egregious systemic way, they could be massive, like $10 million or even 10% of the annual turnover of a supermarket in the preceding 12 months. Now, that runs into the billions. I hope and expect that that wouldn't be activated as a matter of routine, but it would really focus the attention of management.
Craig Emerson, how much of an issue is a fear of repercussions for whistleblowers? So there might be a farmer or producer who's being treated very badly yeah. by the supermarkets but is too worried to speak up because they fear they're going to lose business or be shut out of the market.
It's a huge problem, and it's so endemic that even they, when they speak to us, say, look, this is confidential, okay? they don't want to be named, and even industry associations don't want them to come forward and name themselves because they very much fear retribution, and it can take the sorts of forms I talked about, which is taking their product off the shelf altogether or at least moving it to an unpopular part of the store just because they raised a complaint. So what we're doing there, Sally, is to create a facility where they can make a confidential complaint to the watchdog, the ACCC, so that their identities won't be known.
You haven't recommended laws around divestiture. Why is that?
No. Well, you know, it's one of these, frankly, populist ideas. Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Break them up. Right. So this would have the ACCC going to the courts and under a forced divestiture law, which doesn't exist at the moment, but is supported by, I think, the Nationals and the Greens. Well, who do you sell the stores to? So let's say it's Coles who gets hit by forced divestiture. They're going to sell to Woolworths. What does that do for market concentration? And if they say, well, no, you can't sell to Woolworths because that will increase market concentration, who do they sell to? Oh, well, maybe a foreign multinational, but they don't want to come here. And so the only options then left to start to closing stores, which would terrify their workers, but for the customers, for the shoppers, they'd say, oh, thanks for nothing. You know, like we had a local Woolies or a Coles and it's been closed. So I just can't see the sense of it at all.
Dr. Craig Emerson, former Labor Minister for Small Business and currently the independent reviewer of the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct. and the Prime Minister has weighed in on the interim report. Anthony Albanese told Thomas Orrity a mandatory code could change the power structures that prevent farmers from speaking up.
The government wants a fair go for families and a fair go for farmers. And I think that's what Australians want as well. So this work is all about how do we make our supermarkets as competitive as they can be so that Australians get the best deal possible, whether they be the providers or, of course, the consumers at the checkout.
A fair go for families. I just want to pick up on that because I wonder whether there could be a potential negative impact here, Prime Minister. I mean, obviously the farmers want more money from the supermarkets for their produce, but if the supermarkets go ahead and do that, couldn't they just hike up prices at the checkout and make it more expensive for families?
Well, the gap that's been there is that when prices have fallen for farmers, we've often seen prices continue to increase for consumers at the checkout. And that's why we need transparency. That's why we need a code of conduct that looks at the entire supply chain. And we want a fair go for all. What is happening at the moment is that the power of the supermarkets with just a voluntary code of conduct has seen a lack of confidence in the system. And that's why Dr. Emerson has pointed towards the need for mandating rather than a voluntary code of conduct that essentially is run by the same businesses that are being complained about.
I mean, Dr. Emerson was asked, though, to examine how the guidelines ensure that supermarkets deal fairly with their suppliers. So supply is very much a focus here. Are you confident that review will also reduce prices for consumers, though? We've heard some doubts about that.
Oh, absolutely. And Dr. Emerson's review is certainly looking at the impact on consumers, not just on suppliers. Dr. Emerson's review is focused specifically on the code, but there are other work being undertaken as well, including by the ACCC, looking at competition in the system, including the Senate review, which is taking place.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese speaking to Thomas Orrity. And we can't discuss supermarkets without speaking with those who supply them, farmers. David Jahinki, the president of the National Farmers Federation, says the report is a good first step, but a long way from fixing problems for farmers and for shoppers.
Well, first of all, we obviously welcome the report. It's actually hitting the frustrations that producers have felt throughout this process, and we're really pleased that those thoughts have been captured by having a conversation around making the code mandatory, by making sure the penalties in place, making sure we've got transparency, but also making sure there's penalties there. And just to be clear, the NFF currently doesn't have a divestiture policy, though we do want to make sure the penalties are fit for purpose, and that's something that we still want to work through as a collective of the whole NFF family.
Does the idea of making the code mandatory between supermarkets and farmer suppliers appeal to farmers?
Everybody who's been involved in the process definitely believes that this will be a good step forward. It's not the whole picture, though. It is a segment of the supply chain that it does support, but the supply chain is greater than just that one transaction as well. But it's for us, and listening to farmers and hearing their concerns, definitely a step in the right direction.
The idea of a confidential complaints process is part of the code, but to wield a massive fine that could be 10% of the turnover of a company that would end up being billions of dollars, I'd imagine there would have to be a test of this in court, and farmers would still have to put their neck on the line, wouldn't they, to make accusations about the conduct of a supermarket?
It does two things. First of all, it gives the mechanism, yes, but secondly, it supports the people who speak up and also make sure that there's a protection mechanism in there as proposed to ensure that they don't get commercial retribution back for speaking up. So yes, there's still going to be a process to follow. We're wanting to understand a little bit more on what that looks like as far as either the involvement of getting the code to be activated so that farmers are protected, but then secondly, is there what kind of costs would be involved, noting that you're quite right, the penalties are quite large, and this is what we want them to be as a deterrent so that we don't get to that stage, so that we understand that there's a stick that we can pull out. So for us, it sounds really positive. This is the interim report. We want to know a little bit more as well, but it's all heading in the right direction as far as we're concerned.
It's a major change, but do you really think it will change much in terms of farmers' relationship with supermarkets?
I'm hoping so, Warwick, I really do. Noting that this is one of the many inquiries that are going on to this sector, but the first cab off the rank. And I guess it really, all of this conversation comes down to when a dispute occurs or when there's a negotiation that falls apart, how useful is this? We believe in our conversations, and once again, this is going to help, but ultimately we won't know until the rubber hits the road and that first case gets brought forward or the first circumstance comes forward. And we want to make sure that there is a review process in this as well, once again, to ensure that that these settings are constantly fit for purpose. As we know, when rules are changed, when guidelines are made, we want to make sure that we're capturing as much of the traffic, as much of the contracts, as much of that farmer negotiation as possible.
President of the National Farmers Federation, David Johinke, speaking to Warwick Long. The interim report is open for consultation until April 26. The final report is due before June 30.
From the top end to Tassie, Countrywide on ABC Radio.
How do you know your extra virgin olive oil is really what it says on the bottle? The Olive Oil Quality Monitoring Program has just been relaunched in Australia, which will undertake in-depth testing of the product on Aussie shelves. It comes at a pertinent time for the industry, with long-term droughts in olive-growing regions in Europe heavily impacting supply chains. The Australian Olive Association will conduct the survey, and its chief executive, Michael Southern, says the project will help catch out any producers doing the wrong thing.
It's a program that's been run in the past a few times, and essentially it's a project that allows the industry in Australia to take a snapshot of the quality of the olive oil produced domestically or locally, as well as the olive oils that are being imported. And what we're really looking for is compliance with the Australian standard, which we have for olive oil, and also making sure that there's compliance on the label, so there's no misleading information on the label. And what we've found in the past is that generally this program or this project, where it identifies issues, has certainly helped some producers to fix up any issues that they may have and to become more compliant. So it's a really good way for us as an industry to identify how we're travelling and to make sure that consumers are getting the best value they can for the olive oil that they buy.
As you said, Michael, this is a program that's happened before. Why run it again now? Are there particular concerns in the industry, or is it just time?
Look, it's time, and certainly what we're hearing about, you know, the issues that are happening in the Northern Hemisphere has probably highlighted or heightened our awareness that it is a good time maybe to check, you know, with what's happening with not just imported oils, but also Australian producers as well. So when you have a shortage of the product, as we currently do, because of the ongoing drought in the Northern Hemisphere, particularly affecting Spain, and the resulting shortage where they're probably only producing half of what they would normally produce, that puts pressures along many of the supply chains. And, you know, there could be areas where oils are being brought in that are not what they say they are, or not the quality that they say they are. And we want to make sure that consumers who are paying good money for these products are getting what they expect and what they are paying for. So we don't expect there to be significant issues, but it's certainly a great way to make sure that no one's taking advantage of, if you like, a shortage in the market.
Yes, there has been a lot of problems in Europe with olive oil, and in Spain they even found rings of counterfeit olive oil being produced and sold in supermarkets. Now, there hasn't been any suggestion that that has been exported at this stage, but will this project be looking for anything like that as well?
Yeah, look, we're just looking generally, you know, for compliance. So certainly if there has been any substitution or, you know, anything that is not olive oil, that'll be picked up pretty quickly. And certainly we'd be talking with companies or processors or producers about that. And we would expect that they would, you know, quickly make sure that any future product that comes in does comply. One of the important aspects, though, is to make sure that if people are paying for extra virgin olive oil, which is the majority of what we produce here in Australia, that that is what they are getting, that they're not getting a lesser quality. And also making sure that the labels are true to, you know, to what's in the bottle or in the packaging. And so if there are significant issues or if there are serial offenders, then of course, you know, that can be elevated. But we just want to help consumers have confidence in the products that they are buying here on the shop shelves and buying direct from any local producers.
Chief Executive of the Australian Olive Association, Michael Southern, speaking with Elsie Adamo.
From the paddock to the plate, Countrywide on ABC Radio.
Australia's sugar industry could soar to new heights after a scientific breakthrough brings the industry's biofuel dream closer. But growers say they need better government policy to make sure the renewable fuel is made in Australia. Megan Hughes has this story.
Sugar is a pantry staple in most households, however you use it, for baking or even in your cuppa. It's a large industry in Australia based out of Queensland and northern New South Wales, worth $2.5 billion. But it's in upheaval after three mill closures in 4 years, with Mossman Mill in far north Queensland the latest to shut its doors. Now there's hope a research breakthrough could offer the diversification the industry needs. Scientists have mapped the crop's genome, going right into the DNA and finding out which genes produce certain traits. Report co-author Professor Robert Henry from the University of Queensland explains.
We now will be able to identify the genes that control the sugar content or the disease resistance or other attributes. And so we'll be able to enhance those characteristics by breeding because we'll have the ability to work with the genetics of those sorts of traits.
It may sound arbitrary, but it gives the industry a tool to produce better sugarcane and sugarcane that can be grown for uses other than raw sugar. Sugarcane was brought to Australia on the first fleet in 1788, and until now it's been grown basically just to produce raw sugar. But the crop is incredibly versatile, and it can be used to make biofuels, bioplastics, perfume, and even sustainable fabrics. The principal investigator of the study is CSIRO research scientist Dr. Karen Aitken.
I've been working on sugarcane for about the last 20 years, and sugarcane is the last of the big crop plants that to be sequenced. And the reason for that is because sugarcane has a very complicated genome. It has over 100 chromosomes. And my role in it was I was really interested in getting the genome because it's such a valuable resource for everyone. And I had to get funding, and I found funding was available through the US Department of Energy Community Sequencing Program. And to get the funding, you need to show that the research communities around the world are interested in using the genome sequence.
Now the research is publicly available for anyone internationally to use. Now, when growers choose which varieties of sugarcane to plant, an important quality is how much sugar the plant can yield. But when growing for other things like biofuel production, they need a crop that produces a large biomass, which is the organic material of the plant that can be turned into fuel. And producing a large biomass means potential for a biofuel industry, as Dr. Aitken explains.
We've all heard about the push for biofuel and sustainable aviation fuel, and been able to generate that from biomass and, you know, plant biomass, and in this case sugarcane biomass, means that we are all contributing to a greener planet.
Professor Henry says being able to manufacture aviation fuel from a crop like sugarcane could significantly contribute to achieving Australia's net zero emissions target by 2050.
This seems to be the only option, if you like, if we're going to have jet fuel for those long haul flights. It's going to have to come from a plant source. It's got to be an agricultural product. There's no other option if we don't want to dig it up out of the ground. The 2050 target that the world sort of set itself says that we're going to really be putting in a big effort to achieve these things on that sort of time frame. I'm optimistic that in the next 5 years or so, we'll see at the research level these things being achieved, and maybe by 2030 we'll be that sort of time we'll start to see very significant commercial adoption.
That report from Megan Hughes.
What's on your dinner plate? Countrywide, the politics of food and farming.
A new Australian record has been set for the biggest corn crop. The highest yielding crop was grown on the New South Wales-Victorian border at Tokenwall and has set the bar above 23 tonnes per hectare for the first time in the nation's history. Warwick Long reports.
And it's been pretty mild in terms of temperature, especially early in the season, and that sort of favoured the corn, and we've set a new record.
It's all smiles on a farm near Tokenwall in southern New South Wales, where the new record crop size for corn being grown in Australia has just been set. In fact, 10 days ago, agronomists and farmers were mapping out a little plot in a crop they thought was a record breaker.
We basically mark out an area which is 0.1 of a hectare or a tenth of a hectare. In this case, we measured 164 metres in length, and basically we ran the harvester down that particular area, and then we weigh the grain, and we work backwards on that area, and we're able to achieve 23.267 tonnes.
That's agronomist James Murray from IK Caldwell at Cobram in Victoria. Together, he and farmer Nathan Pate and farm manager Dan Phelan combined to grow the record crop. To set the record, a lot of love and care was put into it. Here's Nathan Pate.
Well, we're very lucky. I think the summer was very kind. It wasn't overly hot, which the corn seemed to really like. And it was very well managed, obviously. Well, Dan's idea, we found just lots of little waterings often, like every couple of days, just 10 mil. And that, I reckon it keeps the crop sort of, like you can walk in it and you feel the humidity and you feel it growing all the time. I think that's been really good, yeah, and not too hot, obviously, for this summer.
So what's the secret? Well, growing corn is like being a CWA veteran trying to bake the perfect sponge or get the perfect scone. At least that's how agronomist James Murray puts it.
The guys that just seem to do things a little better than the next guy, really it's sort of a bit of an add-on effect, but certainly in Dan's case, it's ended up a really good result for them, yeah.
So you think you've got the record. What's that number again?
23.267 was the numbers that we came out with once we corrected the moisture to the right number we needed. That was about a bit more than a tonne better than the previous record. So fantastic.
Breaking the record by a tonne, that's incredible. Did you think in your wildest dreams that you would have got a number like that?
No. Well, I've seen some numbers that pop up on yield monitors when you're harvesting it, but it's quite often only a really small area. But the most impressive thing about this particular field was that even though we were able to achieve 23 tonne, it's very hard to do that over the whole paddock. You'll have, bits that yield better than other areas. But the actual yield of this particular field was above 20 tonne. That's a real feat.
Being the agronomist in this mix too, and I'd imagine it's almost akin to a coach, right, isn't it? You're following along and you're celebrating the success. So do you celebrate, James Murray, when you get a record like this?
I haven't yet, but I was excited for these guys because, like you say, especially when you've been doing it for a while, you're more of a coach than anything, and you've just basically got to encourage them to do their best. And there was certainly Dan and Nathan, they most definitely, they did their best, and it's great to see reward for effort. That's the thing is, I know they didn't take any shortcuts with this particular recipe, and it's good to see that it's paid off for them.
As for farmer Nathan Pate and his new hold on a record in Australian agriculture, he says it's a testament to taking good advice, having good workers, and maybe leaving room for a little bit of celebration.
I'm only listening to what Dan and James say, and I just either nod yes or no. Stick to James's recipe, the soil test, moisture meters, moisture monitoring, good advice, really, yeah.
Do you celebrate now you got a record?
Well, sort of, probably not enough, but we will, yeah. I think it hasn't sort of set in. Like, it, because it's such a little area they test, I was a bit sceptical and I sort of had to sunk in, but obviously now that you bring me, I feel pretty privileged now.
Nathan Pate, a farmer at Tokenwall, who is the owner of the Australian record for best yielding corn crop.
You're listening to Countrywide, across Australia and around the world on ABC Radio.
Australian medicinal cannabis growers say the emerging industry is struggling to survive because of an influx of imported cannabis products flooding the Australian market without testing by Australia's medical regulator. Cannabis producers are calling for urgent regulation of cheap imports they say are killing the local industry and putting patient safety at risk. Elsie Kennedy has the story.
Australia's cannabis industry launched to great fanfare in 2016 when cannabis was legalised here for medicinal purposes for the first time. 8 years later, companies say they're struggling financially as cheap imports have flooded the market, sending minimum prices for cannabis plummeting.
More product pushed into this country at a cheaper price without the kind of cost regulations and challenges that we have does create a very, very difficult situation for us to maintain our revenue growth.
That's outgoing CEO of Can Group, Peter Coetzee. He's calling for urgent government regulation of cheap imports, he says are killing the local industry and putting patient safety at risk.
If the government is serious about having a local industry, it needs to step in and take a look at this situation, because local industry may just slowly peter out and die if we're not careful.
Can Group is one of Australia's oldest medicinal cannabis producers and has invested $170 million in building a high-tech facility on the outskirts of Mildura on the New South Wales-Victorian border. The company is now offering the facility for sale and says it will lease it back in an effort to bring in cash to stay afloat.
You don't take light decisions about moving away from owning that facility and continuing to want to invest in the purpose that it was built for. And I have to also say that it's only now that that facility is really starting to deliver after a lot of years of trial and error and construction. That facility is now starting to deliver the best quality product in Australia.
Are you looking at laying off any staff at this stage?
Look, at the moment, we are always looking at those things. The preservation of our facility in Mildura, which is the engine room of the business, is paramount to us. So the idea of trying to maintain as best we can, but there comes a point at which cash flow becomes an issue and cash flow requires you to take action. So it's not without challenge.
According to industry modelling, about 80% of the medicinal cannabis sold in Australia is imported, taking a big slice of sales in a sector estimated to be worth about $400 million. Data from medicinal cannabis clinic Honolii shows that between January 2022 and January 2024, the minimum price of medicinal cannabis flower products plummeted 57%, from $11.90 per gram to $5 per gram. It's not just Can Group worried about the impact on the local industry. Other medicinal cannabis companies say they're concerned these cheap imports are not being tested by Australia's medical regulator, making it impossible for Australian companies, which must comply with strict standards, to compete on a level playing field.
A lot of people aren't becoming cultivators because of the concern of the financial viability.
That's Nanmari Skouri, CEO of Northern Victorian cannabis company ECS Botanics. She says, as well as the financial impact, she's worried about patient safety.
I guess the concern for us is the regulator said they would make sure that they'd monitor the industry, that they would check that the products did meet specification. But what actually happened is they haven't tested any product, and I don't believe they've checked on any of the packers to make sure they're following the regulations. That's a concern for us, because if the product isn't of the highest standard, this product is used by really ill patients, people with cancer, MS, Parkinson's. And they want to make sure that the product that they're taking is healthy and clean.
That story from Elsie Kennedy. And that's all we have time for on Countrywide today. I'm Lucy Cooper. Catch you next time.